Imagine a philosopher who stands at the crossroads of two towering traditions, phenomenology's rigorous description of experience, and Nietzsche's radical critique of metaphysics, only to reshape the entire landscape of 20th century thought. By the end of this lecture, you'll see how Heidegger inherited, transformed, and projected these ideas forward into existentialism and beyond. This crisis creates fertile ground for two contrasting responses: Nietzsche's radical genealogy and Husserl's phenomenological rigor. By the early 1800s, Immanuel Kant had already turned philosophy on its head with his critique of pure reason, insisting that human knowledge is limited to the structures of the mind, and that we can never grasp things in themselves. That critical turn, while rescuing philosophy from dogmatic metaphysics, also emptied the traditional foundation on which philosophers had built their systems, leaving a vacuum that no one knew how to fill. At the same time, the astonishing success of Newtonian physics and the rise of the natural sciences showed that a mathematically precise, empirically verifiable method could explain everything from planetary motion to chemistry, convincing many that all truth must be scientific. Parallel to this, historicism, championed by figures like Wilhelm Dilthey in the 1860s, argued that ideas are always products of their time and culture, further undermining the notion of timeless, universal truths. As a result, philosophers began to feel that the old abstract speculations were out of step with a world that seemed to demand concrete, lived relevance. Think of the Industrial Revolution's reshaping daily life, the emergence of mass education, and the political upheavals of 1848. People were experiencing reality in new, intense ways, and wanted a philosophy that could speak to those lived moments. This growing demand pushed thinkers toward approaches that would foreground experience itself, whether by dissecting the genealogy of values like Nietzsche later would, or by describing the structures of consciousness as Husserl intended. In the next part of our journey, we will see how Nietzsche's radical critique of morality and his genealogical method rose as a direct answer to this crisis, while Husserl pursued a rigorous phenomenology to rescue meaning from the blur of historicity. While Nietzsche tears down metaphysical scaffolding, Husserl is building a new method to describe experience from the ground up. In 1882, Nietzsche famously proclaimed that God is dead, a striking metaphor for the collapse of the absolute transcendent foundation that had underwritten Western morality and metaphysics since Augustine. This cultural turning point was not a celebration of atheism, but an urgent diagnosis. Without a divine guarantor, values become contingent, and the old notion of an immutable truth loses its authority. Nietzsche responded by arguing that what we call truth is not a timeless mirror of reality, but a linguistic and social construct designed to serve life-affirming, power-enhancing projects. He illustrated this with the example of truth being a mobile army of metaphors that we have forgotten are merely tools for survival. To expose how such concepts hide power dynamics, Nietzsche inaugurated a genealogical method, tracing the historical accidents that turned simple drives into moral imperatives like guilt or sacrifice. This genealogy reveals that moral terms often function as subtle forms of domination, shaping subjects to fit the interests of particular groups. Moreover, Nietzsche foregrounded temporality and historicity as the actual engines of meaning. Values are always in flux, rooted in the specific conditions of a given epoch, and they gain force only as they are reaffirmed or overturned by future generations. In this sense, the will to power is not a mere desire for domination, but a creative force that constantly revalues and reinterprets existence. By dismantling the metaphysical scaffolding and exposing the power structures hidden in language, Nietzsche prepared the ground for a philosophy that is both radically historicist and deeply attuned to the lived, temporal nature of human life. This radical rethinking of truth and power sets the stage for Husserl's parallel project of grounding experience in a rigorous phenomenological description, a tension that will dominate the next part of our intellectual genealogy. Heidegger enters this scene, taking both Nietzsche's historic critique and Husserl's methodological tools to forge a new direction. But before we can see his move, we must first understand how Husserl broke with the dominant psychologism of his time. In the late 19th century, Husserl grew dissatisfied with the view that logic and mathematics were just extensions of empirical psychology, a view championed by figures like Wilhelm Wundt, and he set out to rescue the foundations of knowledge from merely psychological explanation. This breakthrough came with the phenomenological reduction, or epoché, a disciplined suspension of all natural assumptions about the external world, so that we can attend purely to the way things appear to consciousness. By bracketing the existence of objects, the philosopher can describe the structures of experience itself, without slipping back into speculation about hidden mental processes. Central to this description is intentionality, the idea first articulated by Franz Brentano. that consciousness is always about something, a perception, a memory, a judgment, and that this directedness reveals the relational architecture of experience. Husserl then introduced the concept of the life world, the pre-theoretical horizon of meaning that underlies all scientific and philosophical abstractions, a world we live in before we ever begin to formalize it in language or theory. The aim of this rigorous, descriptive science of experience was to establish a firm, transparent basis for all other disciplines, ensuring that philosophy could proceed without collapsing into the subjectivity of psychology. In short, Husserl's phenomenology offered a method to get back to the things themselves, to let the phenomena speak before any theoretical overlay, and it set the stage for Heidegger's own existential turn. Having reoriented phenomenology, Heidegger turns his gaze to the legacy of Nietzsche, seeing him as the last metaphysician. In his 1927 lecture series, Being in Time, he reinterprets Husserl's notion of intentionality, not as a neutral act of consciousness pointing at objects, but as the way Dasein, the human being he calls being there, discloses a world that is already meaningful. For example, when you walk into a kitchen, the smell of coffee and a clatter of dishes are not merely presentational data. They are already woven into the structure of your everyday life, revealing a world that Dasein is always already living in. Heidegger argues that this disclosed world is fundamentally shaped by being toward death, the unavoidable anticipation of our own finitude, which he calls the most basic existential structure. Think of the soldier on the front lines. The knowledge that death may come at any moment intensifies every choice, every relationship, making the possibility of death the horizon against which all meaning is measured. By foregrounding this horizon, Heidegger critiques the Western metaphysical tradition for forgetting, aim itself, a critique that echoes Nietzsche's genealogical attack on the moral and metaphysical assumptions of his time. He shows that metaphysics, in its quest for immutable substances, overlooks the temporal unfolding that makes any conception of being possible. In this way, temporality becomes the horizon of understanding, the past that Dasein inherits, the present in which it projects itself, and the future that is always the possibility of death. This shift from a descriptive phenomenology to an ontological analysis sets the stage for Heidegger's later work, where he deepens the genealogical connection to Nietzsche and begins to expose the hidden assumptions of modern science and technology, leading us to the next phase of his thought. With these insights, Heidegger's project reaches its mature phase in Being in Time, setting the stage for his influence on later existentialism. In the 1920s, Heidegger turned to Nietzsche's famous doctrine of the eternal return, but he did not treat it as a mystical loop of events. Rather, he read it as a temporal structure that reveals how being itself unfolds through history, each moment retrieving a possibility of its own becoming. He took Nietzsche's will to power, traditionally understood as a psychological drive, and reconceived it as the fundamental thrust of being, to disclose itself, a kind of ontic dynamism that pushes truth out of concealment. This reinterpretation allowed Heidegger to transform Nietzsche's genealogical criticism of morality into a method for uncovering the ontological conditions that make any truth possible, a kind of archaeology of the meaning of being. By tracing how concepts like truth, value, and subjectivity have been historically constituted, Heidegger argues that we are not merely mapping cultural changes, but exposing the very horizon in which being can appear as truth. The notion of the history of being that emerges in his lectures of 1927 builds directly on Nietzsche's historicism, turning the genealogical narrative into a philosophical chronicle of the unveiling and veiling of being itself. For example, he points to the shift from the pre-Socratic understanding of being as presence to the medieval emphasis on being as a substance, showing how each epoch's metaphysical stance conditions the next. In this way, genealogy becomes an ontological tool, not just a critique of morality, because it reveals how the structures of thought are rooted in the temporal unfolding of being. As we have seen in the previous sections, Heidegger's appropriation of Husserl's phenomenological method and his reorientation toward Nietzsche's critique converge here, giving us a new way to think about the past, not as an inert backdrop, but as an active contributor to the meaning of existence. Heidegger's reinterpretation does not end with him. It fires the imagination of post-Heideggerian thinkers. Yet his radical turn still rests on the scaffolding that Husserl erected in the early 20th century, especially the phenomenological reduction that brackets everyday assumptions in order to let the things themselves appear. Husserl taught us to suspend the natural attitude, to suspend belief in the world as given, and to describe the pure flow of experience, and Heidegger keeps that move, but he redirects its focus from the transcendental ego to what he calls Dasein, a being in the world whose existence is always already situated. In the 1913 logical investigations, Husserl still clung to a pure, detached subject, whereas in 1927, in Being in Time, Heidegger writes that Dasein is not a thinking subject, but a practical, thrown-into-history possibility, thus breaking with Husserl's emphasis on a detached, timeless consciousness. The continuity lies in their shared commitment to description before explanation. Both insist that philosophy must begin with a careful, lived experience account before moving to metaphysical constructs. However, Heidegger ruptures the Husserlian project by refusing to treat consciousness as a neutral container. Instead, he foregrounds historicity. The fact that Dasein is always oriented toward its own mortality, an aspect that Husserl only hinted at in his later work on time consciousness. This shift makes phenomenology a historic existential inquiry rather than a purely timeless analysis of intentional acts. By keeping a reduction as a methodological tool while abandoning the detached ego, Heidegger opens a space where the lived world, its structures of care, and its finitude become the starting point for philosophy, a move that will later inspire Sartre, Merleau-Ponty, and the whole existential tradition. Beyond Sartre, a new generation of philosophers continues to rework the Husserl-Nietzsche-Heidegger line. Yet before we look ahead, we must see how Sartre, writing in the crucible of post-war France, appropriated Heidegger's analysis of existence as a project of self-definition. In Being and Nothingness, 1943, Sartre takes Heidegger's Dasein, the being that throws itself into the world, and turns it into the human being who must constantly choose, and thereby constitute its own essence. Where Heidegger stressed that our freedom is always bounded by the finitude of death, Sartre pushes the idea further, proclaiming that human freedom is radical and unconditioned. Existence precedes essence, allowing us to imagine ourselves as wholly responsible for every act, regardless of our thrownness. This radical freedom creates a tension with Heidegger's quieter acceptance that we are always already situated within a historical horizon. Sartre's introduction of nothingness, the negation that makes freedom possible, reframes Heidegger's ontological inquiry into an ethics of responsibility, because the void left by our choices forces us to confront the weight of our own values. In practical terms, Sartre moves from Heidegger's abstract analysis of being toward death to an existential praxis. His 1945 lecture, That Existentialism, is a humanism urges individuals to act authentically in everyday situations, from political resistance to personal relationships. Thus, while Sartre inherits the phenomenological toolbox of Husserl and the ontological daring of Heidegger, he redirects it toward a concrete, moral project that demands action rather than contemplation. The next wave of thinkers will take this shift to praxis and push it even further, weaving together existential freedom with social critique. These layered developments point to a broader shift in philosophy that our final synthesis will capture. After Sartre turned existential freedom into a political ethic, Merleau-Ponty pushed phenomenology in a new bodily direction, arguing in 1945 that perception is always already situated in flesh, a lived body that cannot be reduced to a detached consciousness. In his work Phenomenology of Perception, he introduced the concept of the body subject, showing how the life world Husserl described becomes a textured field of sensors, gestures, and movement. Derrida, meanwhile, took Heidegger's ontological horizon of being and treated it as a site of difference in his 1967 essay Difference, showing that meaning is always deferred, and that the very ground of presence is unstable, a move that reverberates Nietzsche's critique of fixed values. In the same decade, Foucault adopted Nietzsche's genealogical method, but redirected it toward the structures of power and knowledge. His 1975 Discipline and Punish maps how modern institutions produce subjects through disciplinary technologies, turning Heidegger's historicity into an analysis of regimes of truth. Across these thinkers, the thread of historicity remains alive. History is not a static backdrop, but a dynamic unfolding that shapes and is shaped by human existence. Embodiment, too, stays central. Merleau-Ponty's body is the medium through which meaning is disclosed, while Foucault's body is the target of biopolitical control. Power, of course, becomes the third pillar, with Derrida exposing the power of language to defer and displace meaning, and Foucault exposing the power of discourses to configure what counts as knowledge. Together they illustrate how a Husserl-Nietzsche-Heidegger lineage has blossomed into a network of ideas that interrogate how we experience, narrate, and govern ourselves, setting the stage for the culminating synthesis at our final section. So we arrive at the crossroads again, this time seeing how each generation has both inherited the map and redrawn it in its own terms. From Husserl's rigorous analysis of pure consciousness in 1900, through Nietzsche's 1886 proclamation that God is dead and his genealogical critique of morality, to Heidegger's 1927 turn toward historic being in the world, we trace a steady migration from abstract metaphysics toward a situated, historic existence. The genealogical method functions like a lantern, exposing the hidden assumptions that bind each era, whether it is Husserl's tacit belief in the timeless transcendental ego, Nietzsche's unspoken valorization of aristocratic power, or Heidegger's lingering ontic politics beneath the poetry of being. When Sartre in 1943 transforms Heidegger's ontological angst into a democratic ethic of freedom, he shows how the same lineage can be reoriented toward political responsibility, a move later amplified by Merleau-Ponty's embodied phenomenology in the 1940s and the post-structural turn of the 1970s. This trajectory tells us that philosophy is not a linear ascent to ever higher truths, but a dialectic between describing lived experience and uncovering the power structures that shape that experience. In contemporary debates, from neuroethical questions about artificial consciousness to climate justice politics, the genealogical lens reminds us to ask whose interests are baked into the foundational concepts of ontology and morality. By returning to the image of the crossroads, we see each thinker standing a fork, picking up the signposts left by the past, while pointing new directions for the next traveler. I invite you to take that same genealogical lantern into your own philosophical inquiries, whether you're puzzling over the nature of digital subjectivity or the ethical obligations of global citizenship, and ask what hidden presuppositions you might be inheriting, and how you might reorient the map for a future generation.